Hello, and welcome to Rabble Radio. It's Friday, September 2nd, 2022. I'm your host, Brianne Doyle. Thanks so much for tuning in. Rabble's got its finger on the beat of the issues that matter to you. If you're curious about the latest news in Canadian politics, labor, environment, or social justice, you've come to the right place. This is news for the rest of us, free of corporate influence. This week on the show, Rabble Labour reporter Gabriella Kalugay-Kasuga joins the Coalition for Women in Journalism founder, Kira Nazish. They talk about protecting female journalists in Canada. The Coalition for Women in Journalism is a New York-based international support organization for female and LGBTQIA journalists from around the globe. After its launch in 2018, it became the first not-for-profit to offer mentorship to female journalists in mid-career from Western and non-Western countries. Today, Nazish joins Kalugay-Kasuga to talk about the increasingly vitriolic landscape female journalists in Canada are facing, particularly journalists of color. In September 2021, Canada was one of the top five countries in the world guilty of cyber violence against women, according to the Coalition for Women in Journalism. What can be done to better protect our female and LGBTQIA journalists in Canada? And what do these staggering statistics say about our media landscape as a whole? Here are Kalugay-Kasuga and Nazish in conversation. Take a listen.
So Karan, to start off, can you tell us a bit about yourself and the Coalition for Women in Journalism?
So the Coalition for Women in Journalism is a New York-based global support organization for women and LGBTQ journalists. And the core work that we do is, you know, we do support work, which involves mentorship, growth-related opportunities. And the other core work that we do is press freedom advocacy and support. So in that, what we do is we monitor press freedom violations against women and LGBTQ journalists from 128 countries. And we sometimes, when it is needed, and when we can, we do emergency support and other forms of support work in those press freedom challenges that journalists face. That involves evacuating journalists, helping relocate journalists. We work with exiled journalists. You know, I think the core of, you know, what we do, if I were to explain briefly and comprehensively, you could say we're kind of something like Reporters Without Borders, but for women and LGBTQ journalists.
I'm sure, like, considering the work you've done, you've heard about the most recent wave of online attacks against women in journalism in Canada. So when you heard about that news, what were some of the thoughts that went through your head?
So not only that we heard about that news, we, in the monitoring work, we document and we keep an eye on everything that's going on. So before you see it in the news, we are monitoring and reporting it actually too. And I will say, you know, Canada has been on our radar for at least 2 years. This happened after Maxime Bernier released email addresses and started trolling women. And today we are talking, you know, while we are having this conversation, almost 1 year later, you know, just 2 days ago, we saw Chrystia Freeland was targeted. So like, I think in the Canadian landscape for women in the media have become very, very precarious and concerning. But just going back briefly, I want to say that, you know, Canada has been on our radar for at least 2 years, but we do see this tendency of targeting women journalists, women in the media in Canada that kind of started somewhere around when Donald Trump was in power and he was doing it in the US, which has changed in the US. Like, I will tell you that our data in the US has dropped significantly of any kind of violations against women since the new government in the US. But in Canada, we see that continue, not only continue, we see these months and weeks, sometimes there's like an uptick, you know, in violence, online violence against women journalists or online trolling or campaigns, which are essentially mobilized. And some of the big trends in Canada we have seen where this has happened is when conservatives are trying to push back on the current government, for example, that's one kind of trend. Secondly, we've seen it during the truckers, you know, rallying. During that time, we see an uptick in violence against women journalists. And whenever Maxime Bernier, but also a few others like him, who have like sometimes utilized the online space to target the media. And when they're targeting the media, they attack women. And when they do that, that kind of creates, you know, more momentum of the public coming after women. In September 2021, Canada was one of the top five countries in terms of online violence on our radar, which is kind of really, really concerning. But I think what happened after that is that, you know, we saw that the real issues of women journalists that were brought up, we published reports about it. We published a report called The Press Versus the Police, where we saw an uptick of police violence when women journalists were going and reporting on Indigenous stories. You probably are familiar with Brandy Moran, what she went through. A few other journalists have also experienced similar, you know, police impediments in Canada, which is really concerning considering this is a democratic country. Then second trend we see in terms of online violence in Canada is targeting of journalists who are either from immigrant background or women of color. We see, when we look at our data, we see particularly majority of the journalists who are getting targeted online is against women of color and women of immigrant backgrounds, refugee journalists. And you will see Black journalists, brown journalists, Asian journalists, and Indigenous journalists particularly targeted in a very vicious manner. So, and we're seeing this violence is happening. So what do we do about it is what matters, right? Where do we go from here? What policies we bring, how newsrooms respond to it and all that. So when this was going on in September, we basically had a lot of conversations with different kinds of people, obviously with a lot of journalists. Two or three of the main things that came out that we suggested and recommended on many forums. One is that newsrooms need to change their policies. This has been since last year, has been a discussion in some newsrooms, but it kind of fell through. When Canada became one of the top five countries, we saw that some newsrooms were concerned and roundtables were set up and some things were mobilizing at the time. But what happened is that everything fell through. None of those things have been followed up. And that is why we see this violence continue. And not only that, women in the media are on a daily basis. You go to the timeline and you look at the Canada journalist timeline and you would see a female journalist getting targeted on a daily basis, right? We are seeing the media coverage on it and we're seeing some concern, but if there are no policy changes within the newsrooms of protecting these journalists, you know, coming together as a united front and, you know, working through this problem of online trolling. And then, you know, unless we are able to make any policy changes, structural changes within the newsroom, outside the newsroom, in the ecosystem, you know, unless we're able to do any of that, it's not going to help. Now, one thing also I want to mention for the perspective is a few days ago, PM Justin Trudeau made a statement on Twitter, you know, condemning the violence against journalists, right? Which is fantastic. We always want governments to get involved. And we appreciate that Justin Trudeau did that. But the problem is that if it ends right there, it doesn't get off your back when you make a statement. And I think what I would like to say is that we don't just need government to make, you know, note of it online, but also to get involved in real policy changes and work with community of journalists and journalism groups. You know, we are here to work. We have a lot of suggestions. We have some really good methods that can really work if implemented, but we need a group of people who are mobilized, willing to implement some changes structurally and policy-wise to protect women journalists. Without that implementation, we will consistently only see not only that this would consistently exist, the online violence, but also that it would grow into becoming, it could become physical violence. And that's, that means that things are getting out of hand.
So last year, you were talking about pushing for changes from in the workplace policy from the newsrooms. What were some of those policies that you were looking for?
So like every newsroom is different, and we understand that. There are smaller newsrooms that can do different kind of work in terms of policy changes and structural changes. And bigger newsrooms can do different kind of work depending on their resources. And our recommendations are according to whatever your news organization can do, right? So one of the top things that we recommend is to create a committee. We want to make sure that every newsroom has at least a small committee or a roundtable situation where they can come together whenever these kind of incidents happen. And that will brainstorm what, how to address these problems and how to protect the journalists and how to deliver the news in the face of these targeted attacks against journalists. The problem is that not only that when journalists are targeted, the journalist is getting affected, the way we deliver news is getting affected. Because when we are not brainstorming about it, we are more likely to caution in how we deliver the news. And that compromises journalism and that impedes journalism. Second thing that we recommended was that every newsroom should have some sort of budget, because without safe journalists, you cannot do safe journalism, right? And so we need every newsroom to understand that in whatever budget that the newsroom has, big or small, that they should have some budget to protect journalists. When women journalists get targeted, we need to have mental health support for them, or the newsroom should need to have either a support system like a mentorship or mental health support therapy, or a combination of those. And the third thing we recommended was newsrooms need to, whenever these online violence happens, it usually happens with one newsroom or two or three, right? So sometimes we see a series of different kinds of journalists getting targeted and sometimes one. And one thing that newsrooms do, which is very harmful and very archaic, is they work independently in silos. So if CBC is going through something, they would not do any kind of support work or assistance or talk about it if Toronto Star journalists are targeted, right? So what I mean to say is that any newsroom it is, I think there needs to be an ecosystem of support between newsrooms. When there's a journalist in any community, whether they're freelancers or working with opposition media, whatever, competitor media, there should be an ecosystem and a unified support system for all journalists, and that newsrooms should report on it equally, should care about it equally, even and especially when it is. But oftentimes I will tell you that women journalists, women of color, LGBTQ journalists, indigenous journalists, and freelance journalists get targeted because they don't have support systems. So when that happens, we need to have newsrooms get on it and work together. So going back to point number one, when they have an internal system and awareness and vigilance to respond to these targeted violence online, they will have that system to be applied into, say, a freelancer who's getting targeted as well in the same way. Because at the end of the day, any kind of online violence or physical violence against any journalist, male or female, happens so that their work can be impeded, or that is one of the goals of these, you know, violent attacks, is to discourage the journalists, to get in the way of them, to distract them, to harass them, right? So at the end of the day, it all affects journalism.
Yeah, and then that brings me to my next question then. You talked about you had seen some newsrooms starting to mobilize. So I was wondering, what had you started to see?
So thank you. I'm sorry, I'm chuckling a little bit because I mean, we saw really good stuff, right? Like we saw in Canada, something that we've been wanting to do in the US a lot and that we weren't able to achieve. We saw mobilization. So women journalists, when they started getting targeted so viciously last year, so what we saw in the newsrooms is newsrooms responding by different kinds of things. Like the internal conversation has been so active and mobilize within a lot of these newsrooms that has not been the culture of these newsrooms. So one thing that we have seen consistently from the beginning in Canada is like oftentimes women journalists talking about newsrooms not listening to them, management not listening to them and accommodating them. Like that's our feedback from most women journalists, right? So in the face of online violence, what we saw is that women journalists started talking about these issues and pushing back. And I think that forced, you know, a lot of management to look into these issues. So I'm not going to name the newsrooms, but in some newsrooms, we saw at least three big television networks where we saw roundtables being set and conversation began within the newsroom where they brought in their journalists and they wanted to understand, okay, what is the issue and what can we do about it? And then there were also some TV programs that were essentially scheduled to do some detailed reporting on these trolling and how women face violence and all that. And we saw a lot of hours of work go into it, if not days and weeks of work that went into that, you know, like having those conversations, listening to problems that reporters face, and also thinking about solutions and reporting it to the public that this is a problem and phenomenon, right? So that's all fantastic. Correct. But then we saw that all of that fell through. All of that feedback was taken from the women journalists, but what they were recommending or asking for, those things were not followed through by the newsrooms. we saw these newsrooms hearing from them, but not addressing those problems. And then it kind of like that energy that was mobilizing kind of dissipated. And now we are seeing online attacks again and again and again. And we're also seeing people getting tired of it. Journalists want to do their job. They want to go out there and report on stories. Editors want to edit the stories and managers want to manage the newsroom. So we don't like talking about violence going on, right? But then we need to tackle this issue. And so we are seeing that now journalists are tired of it and they're taking it for granted that these things happen and no one's going to solve this problem. And inevitably what is happening alongside that is that journalism is getting affected and the way we tell stories is getting affected, and journalists being mindful of whether they should tell a story or not, depending on, you know, how much they will be true. Like, we literally have journalists telling us that they have to do this really mindful, calculation whether they should pursue a story or not, because they will be targeted. What I'm saying is that it is already censoring us. That's concerning.
So then I guess my question is, you know, in the face of this censorship that is being caused by this online violence, you know, and we saw actions starting to be taken, what can we learn from those steps that fell through so that we can react better?
So there's a lot of talk, but there's no implementation, right? There's a lot of talk, we're going to fix this, we're doing this. But there's no follow through within these institutions, which is also, you know, like Lisa Laflamme getting fired. It's kind of like that succinct example. It sort of exemplifies the culture. It's not just about ageism or that she was let go because she's a woman. It signifies our attitude towards things in the industry, right? Because like, no matter what we say, our values are equality, equity, representation, you know, accommodating everybody, finding solutions. These are our values, but our values don't stand on anything. As a software, we need a hardware, and the hardware is implementation.
That makes sense. Connecting the Laflamme story to what we're talking about now, what kind of values do you think are being communicated by what happened there?
I think that the value in terms of, for example, just making the statement that this was a business decision that really succinctly describes what is happening here is to say that we can be reckless with women if it's a business decision. That's what, say, Bell Media is communicating. Institutionally, at the top of our institutions in the media, I think the top management oftentimes, or the leaders oftentimes, do not realize the value of changing times, the value of following and adapting to the changing times. I think that as an industry, we need to understand that from the top down. The down up, a lot of changes are happening. People are in a completely different mood. You know, there's equity, inclusivity is very real, you know, from mid-management to down throughout the industry. Everybody is very vigilant and aware of this and very willing for and committed to having an equitable and inclusive industry and representation in the media, in terms of representation from inside the media, as well as in terms of our coverage. So this is a unified front. But I think what's happening is that, and what we learned from this incident, Lisa Laflamme at CETV is that the top management almost throughout the media is not catching up to that, because they believe that they can still run it as a business and they can be reckless and they don't need to consider, you know, equity, gender equality, and respect for veteran journalists. Lisa is not just a woman with gray hair. She's a veteran journalist who has spent decades of her life in that news channel, but also that even in the last decade, we would see any big stories that CTV was covering. Lisa was involved in brainstorming and ideas and solutions and was loyal to CTV. So her loyalty and expertise that went into the benefit of CTV doing its job better, that they were not able to value that is really disconnected from the reality. So I think that people on the top and all of our media institutions need to realize that actually they need to catch up.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes a lot of sense. Yeah. And so that brings me to my last question. So we have gotten some reactions at this latest wave of violence. One of the actions taken was a letter sent to police chiefs. But as you talked about at the top of this interview, many journalists in Canada have been suppressed by the police. So what kind of solutions are there, that maybe addresses also this tension between press and police?
So great question. Those letters, I think that, again, it's the same, the answer is the same. I think the following through of those letters. So those letters essentially have, and we have communicated with police and public representatives on this issue. And what we have requested is that police, first of all, needs to understand as an institution that without journalism and press freedom, there's no democracy. So we are all working on the same side. Our job is to serve the public. But what's happening internally in police institutions in different cities across Canada is that they're disconnected from that reality. They treat journalists as outsiders. And that is the core of the issue, that they think that they can tell a journalist to be away, or they can be violent towards a journalist, right? The reality is that in a democratic country, that's not, that cannot be legal, because we are all on the same side. So I think that if only those letters can be followed through within these institutions, then that is going to help. The problem is that we have solutions of these problems, and we are just not doing the needed advised things we're not applying the solutions to remove those problems.
That makes sense. So really the way to address this is really following through on our promises as the media.
Absolutely. I would like to mention that according to what we have seen in the last two and a half years in Canada, I think that violence against women journalists is becoming a serious problem, something we are very concerned about, and we are very interested in working on it with anyone who, you know, has a solution, an idea. And I think that anyone who understands the importance of democracy, which is inclusivity for all, this means all sides, left, right, conservative, liberal, doesn't matter, everybody is a citizen, right? So as citizens, I would like to say that every citizen, whenever they see any female journalists get targeted, pay attention to it and do something to de-escalate that. Because there's a part of people who are escalating the situation. But if you're there and you care about the issue and you care about democracy and you care about the values of democracy, then one thing you can do to participate is de-escalate that situation. And I think if you ever encounter violence against women journalists, try to participate by de-escalating, sending a supportive message to the journalist, or, you know, et cetera.
Okay, perfect. Well, thank you so much, Kiran, for coming on the show with me today.
Thank you. My pleasure.
That was Labour reporter Gabriella Kaluge-Kasuga in conversation with Kiran Nazish, founder of the Coalition for Women in Journalism. Thank you so much for that, Gabby and Kiran. Now it's time for a segment we call In Case You Missed It, where we catch you up on all the news of the week on Rabble.ca. Take it away, Nick.
Thanks, Brianne. This week on the site, in Canadian politics, Stephen Wenzel reports on a historic first for LGBTQ policy in Canada. On Monday, August 28th, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, joined by the Minister for Women and Gender Equality and Youth, Marsha Ian, launched the federal 2S LGBTQI+ Action Plan. The action plan is aimed at addressing a series of inequalities in the 2S LGBTQI+ community over the next 5 years. The majority of the $100 million in funding will be put towards 2S LGBTQI+ organizations that provide services and advocate for their communities. The plan will also see Justice Canada launch a public consultation beginning this fall to discuss criminal law reform for issues identified by 2S LGBTQI+ stakeholders. According to the action plan, this includes, quote, the criminalization of purely cosmetic surgeries on intersex children's genitalia until they are mature enough to provide consent, modernizing indecency-based offenses, and limiting prosecutions of persons who fail to disclose their HIV status before otherwise consensual sexual activity. End quote. Also on the site this week, Shreya Kalra asks, what does it say about a society that is willing to spend money on evicting the homeless rather than supporting them? Comparing Canada, the country in which Kalra resides, and India, the country where she grew up, Kalra concludes both countries are failing their houseless population. Kalra writes, India is apathetic. Instead of permanent solutions, politicians would rather offer short-term subsidies to win votes. Canada, too, is apathetic and keeps ignoring the only viable option to curb homelessness, build more permanent affordable housing, a cheaper option than running shelters. In labor news, Gabriela Kaluge-Kasuga examines the unionizing effort being made at different Starbucks locations across Canada after a flurry of activity in the U.S. saw more than 200 Starbucks locations join unions this year. In Canada, a handful of Starbucks locations in BC and Alberta are looking to join the United Steelworkers Union. Starbucks employee Colton Martin explained some of the challenges he faced when he helped organize the Victoria, BC location where he works to join the United Steelworkers. Martin said, quote, "I've definitely run into challenges related to part-time work. Just in terms of high turnover, people don't feel they're going to be at the job very long, so it just doesn't matter to them." He went on to explain that even if employees don't plan on staying at a workplace for long, joining a union will help their co-workers and future employees who join the team. Also this week, Leia Gazan, Member of Parliament for Winnipeg Centre, shared an op-ed with Rabble.ca. She writes, "Far-right extremism is on the rise in Canada, and not only is it putting people's safety at risk, it's also threatening our democracy and the rule of law." She writes, quote, "There is no gray area. This is a growing far-right movement riddled with hate that needs to be named. We must act swiftly and act to stop it. I call on all members of Parliament to name it and to do what is necessary to stop it. This includes Pierre Poilievre, who has been aggressively fueling this fire," end quote. You can read the full version of these stories and much, much more on Rabble.ca.
Thanks, Nick. The last thing we'd like to leave you with, listeners, is this. We are in the home stretch of our summer fundraising campaign. This week, Gabriela Kaluge-Kasuga discusses why they take pride in carrying on Rabble's deep history of reporting on the labor movement.
Media and communications is at a reckoning right now. Many people are realizing that the news is often written by, for, and about a privileged few. And I feel like the role Rabble plays is giving a voice and coverage to the media deserts of the people. And I really appreciate the way Rabble elevates voices of marginalized folks and respects our agency and role in society as we engage with these social, political, and economic issues.
As Gabby said, independent labor reporting is crucial to advancing workers' rights, but truthful stories about workers and unions aren't popular with corporate powers. This means we need your support. Contribute to independent labor reporting today by visiting rabble.ca/donate. And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thanks as always for tuning in. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please rate, review, share Rabble Radio with your friends. It takes 2 seconds to support independent media like Rabble. If you have feedback for the show, we'd love to hear about it. Get in touch with us anytime at editor@rabble.ca. And happy back to school, all! Are you interested in sharing Rabble Radio on your campus, college, or local radio station? Please email brianne@rabble.ca to learn how you could host our show on your programming every week. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on rabble.ca, and thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week.